It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The right to believe is a fundamental human right. Yet around the world, millions of Christians are denied this freedom. Worse, they are actively persecuted because of their faith. Every year, Open Doors publishes the World Watch List to wake up the world to the 50 countries where Christians face the most extreme persecution. And here are the top 5 countries on the list. The most dangerous places in the world to be a Christian. Number 5. Pakistan. Christians in Pakistan are facing unprecedented levels of violence. At least 160 Christian buildings were attacked in 2017. Over 700 Christian women and girls were forcibly married. Convert to Christianity from Islam and you bring shame upon your family. Speak up for your faith and you run the risk of being imprisoned for blasphemy. At number 4, Sudan. The government wants Sudan to be a fully Islamic country. Converting from Islam to another religion is punishable by death. Number 3. Somalia. If you are even suspected of being a Christian in Somalia, you could be murdered on the spot. At least 23 suspected converts were killed last year. Afghanistan is number 2 on the World Watch List. All Afghan Christians are secret believers. If you are discovered to have left Islam, then you could be arrested or beaten up. Your house or business might be destroyed. You might even be killed. At number 1, for the 17th consecutive year, North Korea. The leaders are worshipped as gods, and Christians are considered enemies of the state. An estimated 50 to 70,000 Christians are imprisoned in brutal labor camps. So to follow Jesus here means risking everything.
Sandy Rios with you on this very special day. That was a report from Open Doors, and surely we know intuitively, because it's making the evening news, that Christians around the world are being persecuted in rates and in brutal ways that we haven't seen since the first century of Christianity. I don't often get an opportunity to actually talk about this very much. We're talking about the news and what's happening in D.C., but we don't often speak about this. We know that our missionaries are laying their lives on the line. They've always known that. I remember I was in Urbana at the famous missions conference in 1984 and watched as thousands of college students stood when they were asked if they were willing to give their lives in service of missions. It was a stunning moment, and yet that's what missionaries around the world have been doing for decades. Well, it's my great fortune to count as my dearest friends two people who gave their life to missions a long time ago. And who spent the last 50 years serving in various capacities and missions on the field and back in the United States. It's interesting because we actually raised our kids for a good portion of their early life together. We've had so many experiences together, but I hardly ever have personal friends in the studio. I ask them to come in because I'd like for you to meet my personal friends, but also because they have so much wisdom about what's going on in the world, and I wanted them to be able to share it for you, my listening audience and friends. So let me introduce to you my good friends, Lynn and Judy Everswick. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Sandy.
Hey, Sandy. It's so nice to be here.
How fun, huh?
Yep.
We've done this before. You know, when I was in Chicago, you guys came in.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Lynn, let me go back and introduce the last thing that you did in official capacity. You were the missions pastor for like 20 years at Westover Church. In Greensboro, North Carolina. I think, you know, a lot of people who are in churches, when they think of a missions pastor, a missions program, it's usually it's small. It's kind of the thing that people do. It's kind of, it has importance, but it's not necessarily big. How many missionaries were you guys in charge of there or overseeing?
Well, we had over 112 missionary units, families around the world, serving in over 30 countries, and it was just it was a big job to stay in touch with them and encourage them in their ministry.
And you, I mean, you had a huge budget. I mean, you were, it was like a missions program. Yeah. I mean, it was like a missions agency run out of a church. I'd say that was a better description, wouldn't you?
In a way, except we very much supported mission agencies because we didn't do a lot of the providing information about the fields and all that type of information. That was the agency's responsibility. But we would get our people to a point where they were committed to serving in missions and then hand them off to the mission agency.
How many people would you say, I know you may not know numbers, but how many people would you say actually kind of had their hearts awakened to missions and went in from your ministry time there?
Over the years, there's been many, many, the numbers I couldn't even tell you, quite honestly, but a lot of folk have had a real growing interest in missions. Some of that came about because we initiated a lot of short-term mission trips overseas to different parts of the world, and when they came back, they would be changed forever because they'd have a whole new sense and understanding of what it was to serve in those fields. And when the missionaries from those countries came back to the States, it's like they had a built-in care group because these people now had visited them, understood what was involved in ministry there, and it just turned out to be a wonderful growing experience for them.
Wasn't like coming back to total strangers.
No.
Well, let me finish with your resume here, because before that you were the field director for Team Missions, and for those of people that are unaware, Team was at one time in its life, probably the biggest, besides Southern Baptists, probably they're the big dog around the country because of their numbers. Team Missions was probably, the Evangelical Alliance mission was probably the number, the next largest mission agency.
Well, I don't know that we were the second largest necessarily. I don't know for sure, but we were one of the larger mission agencies. And I know at one point we had over 1,300 missionaries serving around the world.
So you were the field director for them for a number of years. And before that, you grew up in Zimbabwe. And I'm going to come back to that, okay? You grew up in Zimbabwe. Your parents were missionaries.
Right, that's correct.
We're going to get to that part of your life. But I want to introduce Judy. Judy Sherman. No, you got to get close to her.
Okay.
There you go. Judy Everswick, also called to missions, a co-partner with her husband on the mission field, a pastor's wife, and I think Judy, a pastor's wife in the what some of us remember as the traditional role where you partnered in the ministry. You know, a lot of modern day pastor's wives, you know, they have other jobs, other professions, and it's almost become sort of a, it's not expected, and maybe some women don't even want to do that, but you have been a full partner with your husband, Lynn. I've watched it through the years. You have what work he's done, you have shared in. So let me just say that. Also, a former high school counselor. She's had a lot of different works. She has so many gifts. She's the mother of five children. And let me just say that Judy is a dynamo who changes the world wherever she goes. And so, Judy, welcome to my studio.
I am so happy to be here with you. This is so fun.
It is fun. And I want to ask you, first of all, both of you, in your capacity for the last, I'm going to narrow this down a little bit, because you guys have traveled so much, you go out to the mission field to actually minister to the missionaries. And that's been, from my perspective, your main ministry at West. Well, I know you have a ministry there at the church, but you guys go out and you live with them, you counsel their children. So I'm curious, how many countries would you say that you guys have visited this last 20 plus years?
I think we've been to over 60, 60 countries where we've visited, either taken short-term trips with people from a church or with visiting our missionaries and just doing life with them.
Judy, if you were to pick out, and I know this is an impossible question because I know the richness of your experiences, but if you were to pick out, just to give an example of the kinds of unusual circumstances that missionaries find themselves in that they need your help with, what comes to mind?
I think that for some, moms being isolated, bringing up little babies, on a mission field or having to send their children away to boarding school or making that decision, do we homeschool, living in war situations, and what is it like to, how much of the war do you bring into your family so that the kids are aware of where you're living? The decision of making for college, when kids go away to college. There's a lot of challenges that MKs face. And so because of Lynn's and my diverse background, we've been able to speak into a lot of things that have been challenging to the people that are there.
Lynn, what do you think about, what's the challenge for the men on, I know not everything's the same, I understand that. Mm-hmm. But in general, there probably are some themes that men face.
Yeah, very much so. I think when you go out, a man is very much interested in performing the job that he's been sent out to do, the ministry that he's been called to do. So one of the things I really appreciated about our Westover Church was that they allowed Judy and I to travel together. And we tried to stay at least 4 days with the family, because at that point the facade starts coming down and you get to deal with some of the real issues. Judy will go for a walk with the mother or with a single lady who I can't walk with, and she'll gather information. And then by the end of the 4 days, we kind of know what the issues are and how we can help them in that situation. But for men, it's all talking about the ministry and the work, and this is what I've done, and to try and get beyond that to, well, how's your relationship with the family going? How are you doing with the kids and your wife and other relationships with your coworkers is always a big issue. And there are always struggles in so many different directions when you're on the mission field. The whole cultural issue and the governmental issues and the schooling it's endless. So finding those areas where you can focus in that they're struggling with, and you can help deal with that a little bit and pray with them and encourage them and advise them maybe on some alternate plan or something that maybe you've seen and experienced with another couple in another part of the world.
Judy, I know that all these things are confidential, but can you think of some couple that you guys ministered to this past 25 years that really stands out, where you could give a circumstance without giving any kind of clue about who they were, but some situation that really struck you?
Sadly, on the mission field, just like there is in the United States, there's a great problem with sexual abuse. And a lot of times you're in a foreign situation and you have a house helper or a gardener. You have people that have come in to help you or babysit while you're doing the ministry. And sexual abuse is very, very much a part of the situation, and it's fairly hard. We have had the privilege of coming alongside several families whose child has been abused, and to be able to walk the walk with them and to pray and to feel the hurt, to be a cheerleader, to hug, and to just spend time with them when they're so isolated and they feel like no one would know or no one would understand what they've been going through.
I remember one story you told me, and I'm going to just tell the parts I remember. This has been a long time ago. You were ministering to a couple who was, their ministry was in a Muslim area.
Yeah.
And they had, their kids were acting out strangely, and they didn't know what the problem was. And you were able to sort of unpack that and figure out that they had been sexually abused by other children, older children.
Right.
So this is the kind of ministry you've been doing, plus lots of prayer, Bible study, folded in with all that practical counsel. We have to take a commercial break, but when we come back, I want to give you a little bit of insight into Judy and Lynn's backgrounds, because they both have great personal stories. Their personal stories, how they met, and then what God did in their lives in Zimbabwe, where they served for 15 years. So stay tuned to Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you, and a pleasure it is to have my dear friends, Lynn and Judy Everswick, in the studio with me today. They have served God for the last 50 years together on the mission field and then in various, like, 60 countries, as Judy was describing, and more before the last 20 years. So they have seen a tremendous amount in the world. You know, Lynn, I'd be curious to know, as you look at the big picture, which you do look at all the time, where do you see God working right now, particularly? Where do you see his hand? Because he does move in different ways in different times in different places. So where are you seeing the more acutely, more overtly God's work?
Well, I don't... that would be difficult to focus in, because I believe God is working in multiple arenas around the world today. The ones that I'm the most familiar with, I would say East Asia is an area where God has not only worked but continues to work. The whole ministry in China just seems to have blossomed and grown. The house church movement there is sending out people. They had what they called the Back to Jerusalem movement, and anywhere you go around the world, you're going to find Chinese people. And what people don't realize is many of them are believers. They know the Lord, and they're there to share their faith. And incredible commitment that we've seen in the Chinese church today. So that's real growth. But then we also see people from Singapore and other places coordinating efforts to reach out to the whole Mekong Delta region. And there's five or so countries, Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and Thailand. And this whole area there, even though it's strongly Buddhist and Muslim, God's people are going in, and little Bible schools are starting, and churches are starting to blossom, and people from the Philippines are coming over to help plant churches in Cambodia. And I'm just so excited about what God is doing, because some of the darkest areas, some of the areas that have been the most resistant over the years, are now just starting to, it's like the rains have come and the blossoms are starting to percolate up from the ground. And I'm just imagining one day there's going to be a beautiful field of God's people serving all across that region. Another area, obviously, is the Muslim world. I think North Africa, Central and North Africa is little by little, the gospel is getting in. You have things like satellite radio that's sending the gospel in a Muslim-sensitive way into the communities. And God is beginning to use all different ways of reaching people in the Muslim world and in Southern Europe as migrants have come across. And people are on the move. And as people are on the move, God uses his people to enter into that situation. God never wastes a difficult situation. When things are difficult, that's when God seems to really work. And God's people come in. It's like when the tsunami hit. Within 2 weeks, we were in there, and the doors opened up. But that whole area in northern Sumatra was under Sharia law at the time. And yet, because of the tidal wave and the need for assistance, they allowed people to come in and help, hand out food and do counseling and ministry there that was once a closed door. So God gives these hinge events in history. He opens the door a crack, and God's people walk through, and things begin to happen. And I've just loved being a part of that and seeing God do that.
You know, and I think when we grew up in the church, I'll speak for myself, we always thought of the West was sending missionaries, you know, out. Like America was the center, England too. We were sending missionaries out, and that had been the case, really.
Right.
And I remember when I was at that missions conference I mentioned in 1984, I met a Nigerian, and I was doing radio then too, and I said, okay, so I was just on the very front end of doing any kind of radio, so I wasn't a great interviewer, but I wanted to meet him, you know. So what brings you here? Well, I came here as a missionary.
Yeah.
And I was just struck. I think you came to the United States as a missionary, and that sounded so strange to me. But, of course, what you're describing, God calls his people to missions. Mm-hmm. Why should have been such a surprise? And then when I was in China, the many times I was there, the Chinese, I remember them testifying that they felt God was calling them to missions in Muslim countries.
Yes.
So they've been going out into the fields. The Chinese now are becoming missionaries.
Yeah.
Judy, I know you have a million things to say about all that because you've been on the front lines too, watching things change. Like when you went into missions, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. How do you see the differences now in terms of how God's working? How would you describe it?
I think it was, we've just come back from Iraq not too long ago. And while we were in Iraq and in Turkey, there are a lot of Iranian refugees that are fleeing Iran because they've become followers of Jesus Christ. There's huge baptisms taking place in Iran, of all places. And so they're coming into Turkey, and while they're in Turkey, they have that freedom, and they can go to fellowships, and they can find fellowships. And I think that's been one of the really exciting things, is to see some of these people in the countries that open doors and other places are saying, it's closed doors, and yet the work of God is going on, and it's really exciting.
All right, we'll come back to all of that too, but I want to get personal now for a second. Judy, as I'm looking at you talking to me, my dear precious friend, I see your beautiful blue eyes. I'm thinking about little Judy Sherman, the cheerleader, who grew up in Long Island, New York, whose dad was a tugboat captain who I had the privilege of meeting, this big white mustache and the hat and just an incredible story. So you grew up on Long Island, not in a Christian home. Yeah. Tell people how it was that God called you.
My mom and dad moved to Long Island. My mom was pregnant with me. They were not married, so they came to start a new life in Long Island. There was a precious lady that lived across the street from me. Her name was Mrs. Pape. Mrs. Pape was from Germany and came over after World War II. And she reached out, and she saw our family, and she asked my mom and dad if she could start taking me to church. And so I went to church from the time I was a little girl.
But none of the rest of your family.
But none of the rest of my family did. And when I was 15, I was at a Billy Graham crusade in Washington, D.C. Went with thousands of others, and there realized that the things that I had been hearing about Jesus loving me was specifically for me. And the following year, I was at a missions conference at our church. And there was a dear lady that was sitting there, and she was speaking about the need in Africa and said that there are so many that had never heard, that never seen a Bible, that had never been to a church, they didn't have radio, and how in the United States there's churches on every corner, and there's Bibles, and there's radios and TVs. And so God spoke to my heart at that time as a 16-year-old. And through reading the stories of Nate Saint and Through Gates of Splendor, and so I can remember when Len and I went to Quito, Ecuador, and we were in a little airport going down to Shell Station. And I looked around and I said to Len, do you know where we are? And he said, yeah, we're in Quito. And I said, this is where the people that influenced my life to serving God full time served and gave up their life. And as a result of their martyrdom, spoke to my heart, and I gave my heart to Christ and wanted to serve him full time.
So you're 16, you're a little cute cheerleader and a brand new Christian, and God calls you to go to Africa as a missionary. You have no idea how the blank is going to be filled in. And meanwhile, across the globe, there's this kid in Zimbabwe. Lynn, you grew up in Zimbabwe. That's what you knew. I mean, your parents were missionaries. They were some of the first in the country of Zimbabwe, or Rhodesia at the time.
Right. They went out in 1946, right after the war. I was 18 months old at the time. And they began a ministry down in the Zambezi Valley in the north of the country, very, very isolated. And the town was over 100 miles away where we got our supplies. And so everything was brought in by truck. We drank powdered milk. Dad shot all our own meat. He had a shoot for the pot license from the district commissioner, who was British at the time because we were a British Commonwealth nation. And that's where they began ministry. And Mom was a nurse, and she treated people right on a soapbox outside our kitchen door. So.
And you had, there are five of you. Five?
There's four.
Four
of us.
Four of you. Okay. Yes. I'm sure I've met another brother.
Two brothers and a sister.
You don't know about this. Is an announcement, Lynn. No, I'm kidding. I've met your brothers and sisters, but and they all went into missions.
Yes, they did. They all went back and served as missionaries.
Yeah. Okay, so, but Lynn, you know, that's an easy thing to do. You're raised in a mission home, you have missionary parents, and that's all you hear. But God called you somewhere. Yeah, because that doesn't mean you're going to be a missionary.
Yeah.
So what was that about for you, God's call in your life?
Well, Sandy, you know, growing up in a Christian home, you kind of assume that that's what you do. But I remember as a young boy growing up, watching my parents very closely and sensing the joy that they had in the ministry they were doing, even though it was very difficult. I look back now, we have an old 16-millimeter movie of those early days, and I said to Judy, I said, I don't know if we could have done what they did in those early days. And I watched them, and they had such joy in serving Jesus. And so as a young boy growing up, I thought, you know, this is really a wonderful job and a wonderful way to spend your life. And so I always thought I would be a missionary one day, ever since I was little. But I think it was because of my mom and dad's positive attitude toward the ministry that God had called them to.
Did you think you'd go back to Zimbabwe?
I hoped that I would, but I didn't know if I would or not. And especially right before we came back, we were beginning to make plans to come out as missionaries with team. And a guy stood at the back door of the church one day after I'd preached, and he said, Lynn, he said, are you sure you're not going back there just because you're comfortable there and you already know the language, and it's just going back because you're being comfortable, it's what you want to do? And boy, I prayed about that for a couple of days. We wrestled with that one. I said, God, if it's me wanting to go back just because it's a comfort zone thing, then take away my health, take away my passport, do whatever it takes, but don't let me go if it's just me wanting to go. I want to know that it's you sending me and Judy together.
So we skipped a part because, as I recall, you guys both went to Northeastern College. Is that
Northeastern Bible College, yeah.
But is that Minnesota?
New Jersey.
New Jersey, okay, yeah. Sorry. All right, so here worlds clash. Here's this mission kid from Zimbabwe who I can attest to had really hardly any American cultural experience. We've had a lot of fun with that, actually, at your expense, Lynn. So here's Judy. She's in the thick of American culture, Long Island. So when you first met, did that cause a problem? You know, the clash of your experiences, did you see big differences right away?
Yeah, he was very naive. He was very sweet. He had certainly never dated a girl or hung out with a girl. He went to an all-boys school in Zimbabwe and came to the States and, yeah, could tell you lots of stories about that dating time. But the very first night of our college experience, we had to give our testimonies and share why we had come to a Bible college. And I stood up and shared that God was directing me to go to Africa as a missionary. And Lynn?
I checked that off my list right there. I said, because my dad had always told me, when you meet the right girl, you will know it. Well, she said that she was called to go to Africa. I thought that was a pretty good start. The second thing for me was she was quite cute.
So even though you hadn't dated, there was nothing deficient in your interest in girls, right?
No.
You saved it up.
So we dated for the entire 4 years of college and graduated June 3rd, and we're married June 10th, 1967.
Okay, so then you decide you are going to go to Africa. You are going to go to Zimbabwe. You're going to go with team. And Judy, your first trip over there, mm-hmm. You were, as I recall, pregnant.
No, I went with my daughter. She was 2 months old.
Oh, okay.
Kimmy was 2 months when we first went to Zimbabwe.
Okay, so you got pregnant there with twins.
Then we had the four sons. Our four sons were all born in Zimbabwe during the War of Liberation.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. But what was it like? You go over with a two-month-old baby. I bet you had a lot to talk to Lynn's mother about. I bet she gave you, I would think, some advice on
she did.
How to...
Mom was amazing, and having had lived there in the valley for so many years, she shared all the things about don't let your kids go in the water because they could contract parasites, wearing your hat, doing all the things that were so helpful. And as a result, none of my five kids ever got malaria, bilharzia. So we were very, very blessed to have a mom and dad live there. And our first, we spent 4 months in language. He already knew the language, so we stayed a shorter period of time. And the lady that was there really took us in as her own kids, and she shared so much, taught me how to. I mean, I came from New York City, and all of a sudden I had to bake bread, and I had to make all my own food and light the fire to boil the water so that we could bathe our kids.
Well, you're having five kids, yeah.
Yeah. So life was very, very different than it was in New York.
But you thrived, didn't you?
I loved it. Yeah. I was very, very homesick my first Thanksgiving because my family always got together at Thanksgiving. So my first Thanksgiving, we had no telephone. We had no email, of course, or anything like that. So I knew I was going to be very homesick my first Thanksgiving and asked my husband if I could find a turkey. And he said, yes, I could. We went to the butchery, ordered a turkey. I was so excited that I was going to have a turkey. Went to pick it up, and they charged me $45 US for this turkey. And I happily brought it back to the butcher because it was so expensive.
All right, well, Lynn, we'll get your side of the story in just a second. Oh, my goodness. All right, well, when we return, I'm talking with Judy Lynn Everswick, dear friends of mine who were missionaries in Zimbabwe. Actually, they spent 15 years there, started out as Rhodesia, ended up as Zimbabwe. They have so many stories to tell about that part of their life, and we're going to get to that next. So stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I, Robert Gavin Garvin, in terms of Section 96, Subsection 1 of the Constitution of Zimbabwe, hereby formally tender my resignation as the President of the Republic of Zimbabwe with immediate effect.
All right, that was not long ago. That was just last year, wasn't it, Lynn?
Yes.
And that was right. The President of Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. But to go back, to kind of weave the story together if we can, you grew up in Rhodesia. Yeah. When Judy and you went to missions, it was into Rhodesia, which was British rule.
That's right. It was a British colony.
And then somewhere during the time that you and Judy were missionaries there, there was an uprising. Can you sort of describe how what that was all about and how Robert Mugabe came into the picture?
Yeah, it was a very, very difficult time as far as the political side of things and the war and everything else, a very fruitful time for ministry for us, which is another story in itself. But yeah, there were these different groups of nationalist group, the ZANU-PF and the ZAPU, who were different tribes. We have two tribes in Zimbabwe. We have the Ndebele in the south and the Shona, which is the majority tribe in the north of the country. And ZANU-PF was represented, the Shona people. And they were taking young people out of the country for training in Korea, North Korea, and other places in the communist world at the time. And then they were sending them back in, and they were coming in, and they were attacking the farms, and it was a very, very difficult time to do ministry because God had called us to minister to the Vazazuru people, the Shona people, and so we were out in the tribal trust lands doing ministry, but little by little the war was beginning to pinch in, and being a white family one of very few white families in the community. We became an obvious target. And so eventually our leadership pulled us out of there and put us in a little town in the north of the country. But even there, we came under attack a number of times in that town. So it was a difficult, difficult time. But I think where it really came home to us was one day we got a notification from the police just up the road from us. And they said, can you print the name of your child on their suitcase when they go to school? Because we've gotten word that they want to plant a bomb in one of the suitcases. Well, then all of a sudden you begin to realize this is coming in real close to your immediate family. So, yeah, it was a tough time.
Judy, all the kids were born then. And describe what life was like for you as a mom and kind of some of the practical things you endured during the war period.
Well, in many ways it was actually kind of exciting because so many of the we were working in a farming district that was about 25 miles from our house, as well as in the town. And the young women who lived out there, their husbands were farmers, they were quite affluent. But they heard about Jesus, and they wanted to hear more. And so they would start coming in. First, I was traveling out there, and then I got pregnant with the twins, and it was a little bit of a drive to go out there, and there were a lot of attacks on the roads. And so the girls decided that they would come into our house. So they would come in all dressed up in their pretty sundresses and high-heel shoes and have six gun holsters around their waist with their FN rifles, and they'd come into my house for Bible study. It was challenging. There were many ambushes along the road, and we were about one block from the hospital. So many times the helicopters would fly right over our house carrying body bags and delivering the people to the hospital, and then they would call in and ask them to come up and pray with the families. So in many ways it was challenging, but in many ways it caused people to get off the fence. We can live in a life of just pleasure, and we can be enjoying things, and then all of a sudden a tragedy comes or a challenge comes, and we have to make a decision. Am I for God or am I against God? And in our case, it was really exciting because men and women were starting to make that decision to follow Christ, whatever the cost.
You actually saw one or more of your own people get killed, didn't you?
Yeah, there was Lynn many times. We had seven men on our board at the church board, and six of them lost immediate members of the family. So Lynn was doing a funeral a week pretty much most of the time of either our African brothers and sisters or the people in the fellowship.
So Lynn, as a pastor, which is what you were a missionary but pastoring a church, and you had a ministry to the men in the town. I know that. There were a lot of, you know, I would not know this if I didn't know you, that there was such a mining, there was diamond mining, and then they were growing these, like, bulls for...
Yeah, Brahmin bulls.
Brahmin bulls, and yeah, all kinds of trees, a very rich, rich country. Mm-hmm. And so the people that you dealt with in the second half of your ministry, before you were with the Shona tribes, were really wealthy Rhodesians.
Right.
And so how in the world did you, as a pastor, handle all these complications? How does one, first of all, minister... I think Judy's answered this, but how do you minister to people who have so much and live in these gorgeous farms and unspeakably beautiful places?
Yeah, they had their homes and they had their country clubs and they had their polo cross and rugby and cricket and everything. And life was really good for them. And they didn't have anything to do with us. They didn't like us because we were doing ministry to the Shona communities. And so they kind of just kept away from us. But I started playing rugby with some of the young men and made the team, a traveling team with them. And little by little, I got connected with some of these young men whose wives were starting to come to our fellowship. So rugby really became a vehicle for me to get connected with these young men. And then the whole families began coming to the fellowship. And we began to grow. And it was just a great time. But the war took away all the things, all the support that these people had. Their friends no longer came out from the city. The clubs began to decline. They had to put security fences around their farms. Every corner in the house had a weapon at it, and so they were ready when they came under attack. So life was really difficult. All their friends left. Nobody came anymore. But Judy and I were continuing to visit and have fellowship with them. And so our evangelical fellowship there in this little town became the country club for the whole community.
Isn't that something? Isn't that what you said earlier, Lynn? What is so true, that God never wastes these kinds of tragedies. Practically speaking, then Mugabe came to power, and Judy, what happened after? I mean, how would you describe what took place once the war was over and he was in power?
Well, he came into power April 20th, 1980, and we felt like we were bridge builders because we had ministry with Shona people and we had ministry with the white farmers and miners. And so God gave us a really unique ministry. And we stayed on for another 3 years after Mr. Mugabe came in. And when he first came in, he was rather moderate. But through the years now, he has he's gotten old, and communism, and it got really strong, and land grabbing, and everybody lost their farms. Most of our farmer friends lost their farms during that time, leaving with nothing. Many beaten and had nothing, and so have immigrated to other countries, and some are still left in Zimbabwe. But Mr. Mugabe stayed on in the Shona culture. He's a chief, and you stay on for life, and that was what his belief was. But he's gotten quite old, and it was time for him to go.
I know I met you guys when you came back from Zimbabwe, and Lynn, you were given a promotion, you know, team missions, but it was a radical change in both of your lives. I know there was a lot of grief. There was a lot of grief for both of you. What should have been, you know, you're supposed to be this big promotion. You come back to the States with your kids and have a home, you know, was a grief for you. Was it for you? I know it was for Judy. How about for you, Lynn?
Yeah, it wasn't what I had planned. We had gone through, it's too long for this radio program, but God had prepared us for that calling. And when Dr. Winchell came out and said, the board have requested that you consider coming home and serve as a area foreign secretary. It was a real surprise, but we were prepared to say yes at that time. So we did, but it was really difficult. But we learned a lot because then I was given responsibility for the Middle East and for India and Sri Lanka. And I began to learn a lot more about how tough it was to minister in that part of the world. Towards the end,
it prepared you for where you are today.
Yeah, it prepared me for what I'm doing today. But yeah.
You know, I was just that kind of we're almost out of time, but as you see, we've talked about, you know, we've done it in a little bit of a sporadic way. We've gone back into your life, and Judy, when you were called to Africa at 16, and Lynn, as a little boy, you knew you wanted to be a missionary, and you look back on God's work in your life and the tapestry of it. What would you say to Christians right now who are like trying to fit the pieces together of their lives of God's call? What has God taught you about all of that?
I would say I would encourage everyone to be real sensitive to God's call on your life, because if he hasn't called you, then and you try to go in your own strength or your own wisdom, you're not going to make it. Yeah, it's the calling that keeps you. It's that conviction that God is the one who called us here. And when it gets difficult, he's the one that's going to keep you here and make a way for you. But if you trust God and he calls you to go and serve him somewhere, trust him, believe him, and you're going to be surprised what he does with your life.
And I think for me, the biggest thing has been accepting the sovereignty of God, knowing that he is in control of my life, whether it's been sickness. Lynn and I have had some challenges with a few cancers and one of our children being challenged to just come into his own and his walk with the Lord. And you know, we've had those challenges. But when you believe in that God doesn't make mistakes, whoops is not part of God's vocabulary. And when we trust God completely and put our lives in his hands, he is the one that's in control.
Do you see, when you think of prophecy, now we grew up, you know, a lot of prophecy like Ray Stedman, what on earth is going to happen, a lot of preaching about what was going to, what, as you look at the world, I'm guessing that you're just like me, you just see what we've been taught unfolding before our very eyes. Lynn, a word about that.
Yeah, I really believe that the Lord is setting up the nations for the return of Christ. I really believe that. And it's not always the way we expect it to be, but I believe that God knows exactly what he's doing. And so when difficult things happen, and things happen that I wouldn't do it that way, I have to be able to trust God and say, Lord, you know what? You're sovereign. You're at work. You're accomplishing your purposes. Help me to do my part as your child, where you've placed me, to be 100% there, and to be willing to serve you to the best of my ability. I'm available, Lord. Use me as I am. Take me, and if whatever it is, I'll trust you with it, even if I don't like it necessarily. But I believe you're at work in my life.
Judy, how about you?
I think the same. I think trust is a huge part of who we are, and it forms. If we live in fear, it guides our life. It guides everything that we do. And so when we see the circumstances of the world that are going on around us, when we know who holds our future, when we know who has got us here and he's got us in the center of his hand, it takes away that fear factor. It takes away that the anxiety and all the things that can take our focus from God. So when we keep our eyes fixed on Him, it changes our focus and perspective.
You know, a lot of times when people serve God for multiple decades, like you have, their faith ebbs, and I'm sure all of us, because we're human, our faith sometimes ebbs and flows, but sometimes people just don't stay true, or they get off the path theologically or doctrinally, or their bad characteristics overtake them. So what do you think, if there's a secret, what is the key to staying the course?
I think it's really important. I think one of Lynn's and my joy has been these years at Westover is to be cheerleaders so that people finish well. We don't want them to go away tired or discouraged and say, this wasn't worth it. And when you keep your eyes focused on the one who's called you, it makes all the difference in the world.
All right, Judy and Lynn Everswerk. And I have no doubt you're going to finish well. And if you don't, you'll be in trouble with me.
Thank you, Sandy.
Me for that. We love you guys. Judy and Lynn Everswerk, it's always a privilege to be with you. And I'm so glad I was able to share them with the rest of you. So I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening this morning. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.